Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken for me.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we're going to have part two of our interview with Jerry Branum and Phil Williams. We started the show, or this discussion last week, where we talked about the unfortunate passing of Mr. Olympia 2018, Sean Roden, who just passed away about a week ago. And we also got into a discussion of all the recent deaths in the world of bodybuilding. 2021 has seen a lot of deaths in the world of bodybuilding, both younger competitors and older competitors. So I thought it'd be good to bring Jerry on because Jerry's so knowledgeable about nutrition and drugs and the effects on the body that all that has. And so we talked to Jerry. We also talked to Phil. And Phil, of course, was the 1985 MPC Nationals winner. And he went on to win the 1988 Chicago Pro. And Phil has had some bad experience using diuretics himself. So he talked about that a little bit in part one. So in part two of our interview today, we're going to continue our discussion. And we're also going to talk about when they did do drug testing in the IFBB, which was way back in 1990, and the effect that had with the WBF starting up and how a lot of bodybuilders went over to the WBF, maybe because of the drug testing that the IFBB was doing. So it's going to be another interesting discussion with Jerry Branum and Phil Williams. Before we get to that, I wanted to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. So we had a little news again last week. We thought we had another passing in the world of bodybuilding, and this was Victor Richards. Victor, of course, is a very famous bodybuilder, even though he didn't compete a lot. He was known as Mr. Big because he was, without a doubt, one of the biggest bodybuilders in history. And Victor was around mostly in the 1990s, I would say, maybe late 1980s. And he was featured a lot in the magazines, and he was very popular, did a lot of guest posing. And Victor was just huge, like 300 pounds. And this was at a time when bodybuilders were not this big. But he never competed. He competed when he was younger. Actually, Rich Gaspari beat him in one of those Muscle Mania shows in California as a teenager. But, yeah, Victor never really competed. I believe he was a pro bodybuilder. But he's famous for just being so huge. And there was one time when they had a FIBO show in Germany, and they had all the bodybuilders on stage, and he was standing actually next to Dorian Yates. And this was when Dorian was Mr. Olympia. So this had to be in the mid-1990s. And he matched up pretty well with Dorian. So anyways, the rumor was last weekend that Victor had passed at 56 years old. And it was reported on all the bodybuilding media outlets, Generation Iron, RX Muscle, Muscular Development. And then about a day later, I think, or maybe even that same day, we all got news that Victor's daughter said that he was alive and well, and I guess he was on vacation, and he finally responded. I think it was just yesterday or today, he made a video on YouTube that he was okay.
So thank God that Victor is still alive. I thought we had another death report on this week, but it was not to be. So that's good news. Victor Richards is still alive. And he also looked very downsized. I heard he was still big, but he didn't look big in the video. I didn't watch the video, but he looked almost kind of normal size. So anyways, I'm just glad to hear that Victor is doing okay. And we didn't have any more deaths this last week. I did want to mention a couple of birthdays that we had. Sameer Banoot, Mr. Olympia, 1983, a fan of the show and a friend of the show, was born on November 7th. So happy birthday, Sameer. Sameer is now 66 years old. I think he was 27 when he won the Mr. Olympia. So how time flies. Lee Haney was born on November 11th. So Lee just had a birthday last week. He is 62 years old. And just this last weekend, I want to mention Lee had his contest, which was called the Lee Haney Games out in Atlanta, Georgia. And he gave a Lifetime Achievement Award to Robbie Robinson. So that was pretty cool. I saw that on Instagram today. And he said how Robbie was his idol and how he hung up pictures of Robbie all over his room. And I think he even had a T-shirt made with Robbie's body on it. You know, so Lee was a huge fan of Robbie Robinson. And I think Robbie was his favorite bodybuilder growing up. And so coincidentally, he got to compete against Robbie in his very first pro show, which was the 1983 World Professional Championships, which I think took place in Atlantic City. And I believe Lee beat Robbie in that show because I think Lee was in third place and Robbie was in fourth. So that was pretty wild that he beat his idol in his first contest, his first professional contest. Lee also did something pretty cool at this last contest promotion, the Lee Haney Games. I guess his wife, Shirley, was the one who put it together. It was called the Lee Haney Experience. And he had all of his standout trophies on a table, each one, you know, from 1984 all the way to 1991. And he had a little plaque or a picture of himself when he won the contest and a little bit about the history where the contest took place. Like the 1985 one was in Brussels, Belgium, and 1984, his first one was in New York City. And he also had the trophy from the MPC Nationals. He had the trophy from the Junior Nationals that he won in 1982. He had his trophy from the World Amateur Championships, the Mr. Universe, which he won in Belgium as well. And that was from 1982. He had some of his posing trunks on display. So it was really, really cool. A lot of people don't even have their trophies. A lot of these champion bodybuilders don't even keep their trophies, but Lee had them all. And he put them on display so we could all see them. So that was very, very cool. And I think Lee has plans to do the Lee Haney Games in other cities, maybe even other countries. So I hope he's successful with that. And it seemed like he had a really good turnout for this last weekend. Lou Ferrigno also had a birthday on November 9th. And Lou is now 70 years old. So very good birthday for Lou Ferrigno. He was born in 1951. And that was also the birthday of Ed Corney. A little trivia here. If you guys seen the movie Pumping Iron, at the end of the movie, after the contest is over, when Arnold is smoking the joint on the couch, they start singing Happy Birthday to Lou. If you notice in the movie, if you watch it again, they said, we got to sing Happy Birthday to Lou. It's Lou's birthday day today too. Well, when they said two, that means that it was also Ed Corney's birthday. And the cake actually might have been for Ed Corney. And you see Ed Corney in the background eating cake. So after they celebrated Ed's birthday, they must have celebrated Lou's, but they cut that part out. So yeah, Ed Corney, I believe would have been about 86 years old. No, I think he was older than that. Probably in his late 80s. So it would have been Ed's birthday as well on November 9th. All right. So what else we got going on? So in tribute to Lou's birthday, I'm going to read an article from the April 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine. At this point in 1980, Joe Weider was calling his Muscle Builder magazine. He changed it to Muscle and Fitness. And there was an article in there called The Two Faces of Lou Ferrigno, which was written by Bill Reynolds, editor in chief, and talks about Lou's role as the Hulk. So this should be interesting. So as soon as our interview is complete with Jerry Branham and Phil Williams, I'm going to read this article about Lou Ferrigno. So stay tuned for that after the interview. All right. And we did get a couple emails. I want to read those. This one was from John Hartman. John has written to us several times. He's a fan of the show. He said, "Hey, John, I listened to your latest episode yesterday. Congratulations on your new job. That's so cool that you can coach full time and have more free time. The episode was great. Jerry and Phil are great guests. The article at the end was, quote, interesting. I feel like there's about a 5% chance that Arnie was being honest about the extra 5% the drugs added to his physique." Later, John Hartman. All right, John, thank you. That was the only email we got. So you guys can email me now that we are back. My email address is naturalolympia@gmail.com. I also had another email on Apple Podcasts. And, of course, our show is available on Apple Podcasts if you want to listen to it there. And this one said, it's by UBFit. And it says, "The best bodybuilding show. I got hooked on bodybuilding during the golden era, and I am still hooked at age 66. John is one of the best interviewers in the sport. The scope of his guest is outstanding and always informative and entertaining. True bodybuilding is found in the classic division, not in open bodybuilding." All right. Thank you. From UBFit on our Apple Podcast. So thank you, guys. And like I said, if you want to email me about this week's show, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, guys. With any further ado, here is our second part of our interview with Jerry Branum and Phil Williams, where we talk about the unfortunate passing of Sean Roden and also what is going on in the world of bodybuilding with all these recent deaths. Here we go.
I mean, there's been also a couple of, John, I mean, you probably know who, maybe you do, Phil, a couple of female bodybuilders apparently have died.
I've heard, yes.
Yeah.
Again, weren't old. One woman was 49, I remember. I think it was, and then I saw.
Yeah. One girl was, I think her name was, I wrote it down, Lena Kosanova from the Czech Republic. She was 46. There was also a girl named, who died a couple months ago, Sophia Graham, who was 27.
27. Wow. Yeah. Now, come on now. You know, for crying out loud, do you know what she died from, John? Do you know?
I think that was pre-contest, so, you know, probably diuretics, yeah.
Okay. I mean, women, premenopausal women are practically immune from heart disease because the higher estrogen levels, like I said, it maintains her artery suppleness or maintains HDL. For a woman at 27 to die, she had to do something very wrong.
Yeah.
Diuretic, something like that, you know, you know.
Here, did you ever hear what Matt Mendenhall died of?
No, I never heard. I never heard
either, because he died several months ago, but I don't think they ever said what it was.
He wasn't that old either. How old was
61.
He?
61. He's 61, yeah.
He wasn't that old. I mean, you know.
No.
But I mean, I saw another girl in a video where, you know, she was describing, I think I talked about this, John. She was describing her drug regime. And now, get this. She was so weak that when she was interviewed, she was lying down and looking up. She couldn't even sit up.
Mm.
And she was mentioning the drug regime that her coach gave her.
Right.
And she mentioned that she had permanent heart damage and would probably need a heart transplant.
Wow. Right.
When I heard that, my jaw dropped. I mean, this is not an old woman.
Is she still competing or she was done?
I think she's done, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the next statement is what really blew my mind. The guy who was interviewing this says, well, you know, what do you think of that coach who told you to take this thing that just wrecked your health? She said, oh, I have nothing against him. We're still good friends. What? What?
Wow.
What? Wow. Lady, are you freaking crazy? This guy almost killed you. You know, and her defense of him was, and this is another winning statement. Well, you know, he didn't force me to take it. I took it on my own, so I can't really be mad at him. Yeah, but you trusted him.
Yeah.
You trusted him that it would get you in shape without causing permanent damage to your health. I said, you're taking the responsibility from him. You're out of your mind, lady, is all I'd say, you know?
Hmm. Wow. You know, I've been in this sport for 40 years myself, and I noticed a huge difference between, like, back in the day, no one ever discussed steroids.
No.
No one talked about them. And now with the internet, I guess, I mean, Rich Piana, right, was probably the first one to come out and just talk about them openly. And I think that's what was part of his popularity was people like, oh, I love this guy because he's honest.
Right.
And everybody's been lying about drug use for years. Here's a guy who's finally honest about it. But now it seems like
people don't have any problem saying, hey, what do you take? What do you take? You know, and there's like, nobody has to say any, I mean, everybody has to be transparent about everything now because it's on the internet, you know? And so people openly talk about them. Does that make it, more like easier to take them or more acceptable to take them? You know what I mean?
I don't know. And I'll tell you something interesting about Pian. I think you guys will confirm this. If you ever looked at some, I used to watch his videos just for the hell of it. You know, I didn't watch them all, but occasionally. And I noticed he underwent a change. When he first started doing the videos, like you said, John, he was very open about steroid use. He talked about various types of steroids, their qualities, what they do, supposedly. But somewhere along the line, and I think it's because he apparently did some sort of market survey where he found out that the majority of his viewers. Now, when Rich would put on a video on YouTube, within one day, I looked at his numbers because I was doing videos myself. When I would put a video, I'd be lucky to get 900 views the next day if I was lucky. Mm-hmm. When he put on a video the next day, he had 250,000 views in the same amount of time.
Wow. In a day.
In a day. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, who is watching it? Then the answer came. Most of his viewers were between 18 and 22 years of age, right? Mm-hmm. And it made sense to me because I analyzed. I said, why would these young guys, like, really look at this guy? First of all, he was giving out the information on the drugs. That was one motivator. He was giving out the secrets. They thought it was the secrets.
Yeah.
The big like him. Second of all, think back, Phil and John, when you were young. What would you think if you saw a guy like that with arms the size of a freaking tree trunk? You'd say, wow, I want to get arms like that guy. Right. I'm going to watch him. Maybe he'll tell me how he got those huge arms. He's gigantic. Look at him.
Yeah.
You know? So it was young kids. Now, to his credit, and I never got to know Piano, but I met him a couple of – I never knew him really. But to his credit, his later videos, if you look at him, he went in the opposite direction. Hmm. His philosophy changed when he started to say, look, he says, I've been very forthcoming about steroid use, but the truth of the matter is, if you're not going to compete, if you have no intentions of competing, you have no business and you're an idiot if you use steroids. Hmm. He said it just like that.
Change of heart.
He changed because he realized that he wasn't a bad guy. He realized that these kids who looked up to him, are going to follow him. And if they use the drugs that he talked about in the past, like Trenbolone and some of these other, they're going to get really screwed up.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe even die. So he was a nice enough guy to try and, in the last couple of, year or two, he was literally anti-steroid, anti-growth hormone. He said, there's no reason to take it if you're not going to compete, you know, which was, that was nice of him, you know.
I'll tell you guys a story. I trained with Samir. I lived with Samir. In 81, I moved to California, and he let me stay with him for 4 to 6 weeks. I believe it was about 6 weeks until I found the place.
Wait a minute. Before you go on, Phil, today's Samir's birthday.
Yeah, today's birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday, Samir. Yeah, I sent him a happy birthday
Go ahead,
text.
Bro. Yeah.
And I was with him, spent time with him. We got to know each other very well. I lived in his apartment with him for about 6 weeks. Another guy, Ali Mala, was a workout partner for a while, right?
Yeah.
I trained with Ray Mincer for a time. I got to know Mike real well. The subject of steroids never came up.
Wow.
We never talked about it. I mean, there was an opportunity to probably.
Sure.
I never brought it up and they never mentioned it.
Yeah.
We talked about training. We talked about eating this and that, but the subject never came up.
Hmm.
So they weren't really. They used it where it needed to be used, right? But they weren't like, they didn't glorify it in any way.
Yeah.
It was just something you had to do, and that was it. And like I said, it was never discussed.
Yeah. You know, when the guys would get together in the 70s, just to confirm what you're saying, Phil, you know, Arnold and all those guys, you know, back to the original goal, I've been out with these guys a lot. I don't remember any time, even one time, that the discussion turned down when they started talking about steroids. I never, ever heard that once.
So was that because it wasn't a big part of the protocol or because they were just discussed?
Well, they weren't glorified.
They weren't glorified. Yeah. And I don't think these guys put as much emphasis on steroids as the guys do today. In other words, the guys today would look at large doses of steroids as absolutely essential. You know, whereas back in those days, as Phil points out, steroids are more of a tool to be used in conjunction with hard training and good nutrition. They want the be all and end all of bodybuilding success. Today it's reversed. Where today, where steroids are number one and the training and diet are a vast.
Take a back seat to that.
It's reversed. And this is a very dangerous trend because these people have this idiotic notion that you can get away with taking large doses of steroids and not pay a price. Bullshit. A tenant of pharmacology, there's an old saying, guy Paracelsus said this God knows how many centuries ago, only the dose determines the poison. You know, in other words, when you can't take large doses of something and not, especially, you know, for extended times, and not expect to pay a price sooner or later.
Absolutely.
If you're lucky, you'll live. If you're not, well, you know, you see what happens, you know.
Yeah. Well, this is what's happening.
Well, it seems like every decade, well, it's competition, right? So the competition gets harder and harder, and then everybody's forced to do more and more and more.
More and more.
I'll tell you what I think. If you say to me, well, what can be done about this? What can we do to maybe help protect these bodybuilders who are going to take these drugs? There's no freaking drug testing. It's all bullshit. I mean, I'll say it. I don't care. I'm not involved in any magazines. The governing bodies of bodybuilding, they don't give two shits about these guys' health. They don't give a fuck. The guy who owns all the magazines, he talks big, but he's not doing anything to help ensure the health of these bodybuilders. To really help these guys, and women, there has to be some sort of medical protocol in place. You know what I'm saying? In other words, there's got to be regular medical exams and blood tests done. The thing is that, in other words, they got the money to do it. They should institute some sort of medical testing program where, and I'm not talking about off-season steroid tests. That's good too. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, they're not going to test these guys. We talked about this before, John. Remember what happened in the 1990
Olympia?
I mean, they tried the drug testing 1 year, and supposedly the guys didn't look in top shape, and the powers that be that ran bodybuilding said no more. Because if the guys don't look freaky, we're going to lose the fans and this and that. Forget about drug testing at cons. It's not going to happen. So what you can do is institute some sort of year-round, not just before a show, year-round medical testing program where the guys and the women undergo tests, like, for example, calcium, calcium scanning of the arteries, which is an early sign of we can predict an impending heart attack or stroke, various blood tests. It might sound crazy. I think it should be done once a month. In other words, if these people
are going to be able to do that with all the competitors,
they'd have to. But that's the only way to do it. Because if these people are going to stay, as you say, John, if they're going to stay on large doses year round, you better test them every month. Because I personally believe whether a governing body or the athletes themselves pay for it, it has to be done. Because if you don't do that, you don't know what the fuck's going to happen. And you could wind up like Sean Rhodes, any of these. And again, I'm not saying steroids killed Sean Rhodes. What I'm saying is if you take the high-dose drugs all around, you don't know what's going on inside you unless you get checked. And if you get checked and something shows up that you're heading for a brick wall, it gives you a chance to get off the stuff and save your freaking life. You know, otherwise, if they keep doing this, it's going to happen, as Bill says.
This is going to continue.
It's just going to continue.
You know, you mentioned that 1990 Olympia, and we've talked about that many times. And like you said, the guys – well, first of all, there was no foolproof test for testing everybody. If they had a foolproof test, I could see them going forward with it. But the other thing was, which is a thing that people kind of forget about what happened at that year, was that was the year the WBF was being formed.
Right.
Tom Platz showed up at that 1990 Olympia, and he was the recruiter, and he was going out and trying to get all the guys to join the WBF, which started the next year. And I think, I'm not sure, but maybe the IFBB's, one of the reasons the IFBB decided to not do the drug testing was because I heard that Tom Platz was telling the guys, hey, you won't have to worry about this drug testing crap.
Right.
You guys can get as big and freaky as you want. Which was ironic because what happened was a couple of years later, they did end up drug testing them.
Drug testing, yeah.
But I always thought maybe the IFBB would say, whoa, if we start drug testing and our guys are downsized and the fans don't like that, and then some other rival organization starts up and says, wait, we're not doing drug testing. We're going to give you guys what you want. We're going to give these guys, they're going to be big and freaky.
Yeah.
There goes the IFBB, and then the other organization is going to take over.
That's probably true.
That could have entered into it for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That could have been, but the bottom line is that, you know, these guys are playing Russian roulette, and the women, you know, they're listening to these so-called coaches who have no medical background, don't really know the pharmacology of these drugs. And worst of all, they don't know what to do if a problem does come up.
Yeah.
They don't have the medical background.
Right.
Like let's say that, it probably still happens occasionally, like what happened to Phil and Mike Matarazzo. Let's say they take a potassium sparing drug and the coach tells them to, you know, pump in the potassium at the same time and they start to get all screwed up. I mean, does the coach know what to do? He better. Otherwise, this person could die.
Yeah.
Probably not. Yeah.
Well,
you know, I did an interview with Lee Labrada years ago and we were talking about the 1990 Olympia and he was all in favor of it. And he said, you know, I know that first year it was kind of an experiment and some of the guys, you know, didn't look as good. And that was the main complaint, was the competitors didn't look as good. But he goes, if they would have stuck with it, the guys would have learned to deal with doing maybe less drugs. Maybe they weren't all drug free. Maybe they just got by enough to pass the test or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
But it would have led to a better sport, he thinks. And it also would have led to better sponsorships. You know, everybody complains about the money. There's not enough money in bodybuilding. You know, he said, well, if you guys want a sport like this, then expect lower money because you're not going to get the sponsors. You're not going to get the big sponsors. The big corporate sponsors aren't going to put millions of dollars in. I was watching something on TV the other day, women's rodeo, and they were talking about millions of dollars for women's rodeo. I'm like, man.
If you go to England and you throw darts, dart players make more money than bodybuilders.
Yeah.
And that's no joke.
I remember one
year. A beer in one hand and a dart in the other.
I remember one year. Do you remember how Ben Weider, with like his big passion in life, get bodybuilding in the Olympics?
The Olympics.
Yeah. I remember one year. I mean, he used to schmooze all these Olympic officials, hang out with them and give them money, you know, to try and get. He thought that bodybuilding getting the Olympics would give a certain amount of respectability. Mm-hmm. To bodybuilding that it didn't have, because, you know, to the average person on the street, you know, they saw the guys with baby oil and trunks and they thought these were guys with freaks and, you know, whatever. You know, he felt that the Olympics, getting the Olympics, which is the upper echelon of sport, would give a certain level of respectability to bodybuilding. But, you know, and he came close to it one year, but, and he started, and what he did was he instituted drug testing regularly in the amateur division, like the world championships.
Yeah.
I remember, what was it, 87? Where 86. Was it 86?
First year, Gary, 86, because I was in 85.
Okay.
And they started drug testing the next year.
Okay. Next year, yeah.
Wasn't Ralph Mueller, if I remember, had gotten fourth in the show?
Correct.
And the three guys ahead of all got busted.
I just qualified.
He wound up winning, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
You know, you had that type of thing. But so what happened was he was just this far away. It's the truth. They actually made an announcement. Do you remember that? They were going to put bodybuilding in as a so-called spectator sport, which is the first step to becoming an official Olympic sport.
Right.
It was the first step. But what happened was at the last minute, it fell through. But at the same time, this is what I'm leading up to. It's going to make you laugh. What was approved as a spectator sport for the Olympics was hula hoop.
Hula hoop's probably in the Olympics. Am I right?
Yeah, I think it is.
There you go.
In other words, they wouldn't want bodybuilding where guys literally and women knock themselves out.
Right.
Really, it's one of the toughest things you do because, you know, but they allow somebody to take a plastic hoop and swing it around, which doesn't take much skill at all. That made it as an Olympic spectator sport, but bodybuilding was out. And to this day, there's no bodybuilding of any kind in the Olympics.
They don't speak of it anymore. They no longer speak of it.
Nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
The bodybuilding is so tainted with steroid use. That the Olympic officials, if you, I can imagine approaching, let's say one of these guys on the International Olympic Committee. Sir, would you consider body? You go like, he's the killer. You probably run away down the street. He wouldn't even talk to you.
Yeah, you got to give Ben credit though for trying to make it legitimate sport. Yeah.
No, I do give him credit, but can you imagine what if these the Olympic officials, you know, you go up to them and say, well, you know, bodybuilding, we're trying to clean up the sport. Here, let me show you a picture of the current Mr. Olympia. And they show,
Right.
Forget it.
The Olympics, I think the Olympics doesn't have the prestige it used to have either, you know.
Well, that's true too.
That's
true. Like it did in the '70s and eighties.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I tell you, I tried to watch some of the recent Olympics and most of it bored the shit out of me.
Yeah. The last one. Yeah.
It wasn't very exciting at all. You know. But, you know,
isn't it really all up to the competitors themselves on how far they want to take this?
Absolutely.
That's right.
No one's forcing you to do it. So
right.
Absolutely.
But you know what the attitude of a lot of the competitors are? Do you remember the famous statement, Phil, you remember this? It was made by Tom Platz, the same Tom Platz. They said to him, if you could be the greatest bodybuilder, win Mr. Olympia, but drop dead the next day, you know, if you took something that would make you the greatest bodybuilder, Mr. Olympia, but it caused you to drop dead the next day, would you do it? Yeah, without hesitation, yes.
Yeah.
At that time, I need that. What? And they've also asked Olympic athletes over the years.
Yeah.
Could do anything to be a great athlete. Let's say in the Olympics, for example, and it took 10 years off your life. Would you do it? They all said yes.
That's right. Yeah. That's true. But, you know the attitude of a lot of the top guys as far as the drug use goes, they think it's something that they need to do because they said the way human beings are, there's always an inborn need to progress, to go forward. In other words, in bodybuilding or pro bodybuilding mainly, I would translate into being bigger and bigger and bigger. In other words, so, you know, Big Ramey is big, you know, but there'll probably be guys down the line that, remember, he's only 5'10", Big Ramey. I mean, what if a guy comes along who's 6'3", has a bigger structure than Ramey, and now, you know, Ramey competes at 300, this guy's on stage at 370.
Yeah.
I mean, my point is, where will it end?
Right.
In the graveyard, Jerry.
Yeah.
In the graveyard.
Yeah. I mean, I get a picture of, if this shit keeps up, I mean, I get a picture of watching a pro show where suddenly, you know, they're standing on stage and three of the guys suddenly fall to the stage dead on stage. How's that going to help with the popularity?
I remember Bill Pearl told me that years ago, like 20, 30 years ago. He said, one day, somebody's going to drop dead on stage.
Oh, I've seen it come close.
That happened.
I was at a contest years ago. I was sitting with Tom Dieters, remember, who was also working for Weider. And we were watching these guys. They were lined up on stage. You guys remember a big bodybuilder from New Jersey named Johnny Moran?
Yeah. Sure. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I was looking at the guys and we were, you know, my eyes were scanning up and down the line of all the guys, you know, competing. And then suddenly Dieters and I at the same time focused on Johnny Moran because he started to sway.
Oh,
yeah. To go like this, right?
Remember that.
And he was standing at the edge of the top platform. If he would have passed out, he would have smashed into the ground. His head would have probably hit the wooden platform.
Yeah.
Might have killed himself.
Yeah.
So I nudged Dieters, you know, and I said, Dieters, look at Johnny, man. He's about to pass out. We got to do something. So just out of like a dramatic scene in the movie, Dieters and I rushed up and we grabbed and we actually caught Johnny Moran about 2 seconds before he's about to fall down off the stage.
Wow.
And we brought him back. And luckily, you know, he was okay. He was totally dehydrated. You know, we gave him some water. About 20 minutes later, he was okay. But I'm saying that, you know, this thing can happen. You know, that was in front of a whole crowd. The guy could have passed out right on stage.
Yeah.
I've been backstage at contests where when I used to go to the Nationals, I had a habit of interviewing just about everybody in the contest. I do little short interviews. I've seen at least 10 different occasions where bodybuilders passed out.
Sure.
Something from backstage. Yeah. You ever see that, Phil? They passed out.
Yeah, it became common.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking to a guy in an interview, and I was saying, so how did you do any? I always had the standard question. Did you do anything, especially if they had competed like before? I'd say, well, did you do anything different in preparation for this year's contest? And I held the tape recorder, and suddenly the guy's eyes rolled back. I just laughed. And he fell flat on his back with his eyes rolled back in his head.
Right.
So I said, is that your answer? No, the guy, again, it was a diuretic thing. The guy had overdid.
Yeah.
Luckily, he was okay. He didn't die or anything like that. But, you know, these things happen. I mean, in some ways, bodybuilding has become a dangerous sport.
Yeah.
You know, I'm writing now an article for my newsletter. Even as we speak, I'm writing an article on how steroids affect the brain. And I had a couple of eye-opening things. Like, for example, just to give you one example, you know the famous steroid Trenbolone, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not a commercial. It's basically a black market steroid. Yeah, it hasn't been made by any pharmaceutical company in years, right? Huh. Well, it turns out Trenbolone causes brain damage. Mm. What it does is it causes changes in your brain, the same changes that occur with Alzheimer's disease. It causes the buildup of these two abnormal proteins that are thought to be the cause of Alzheimer's, and it starts right away. Now, honestly, they've only shown this in animal studies because to show this, you got to basically take the brain out of the head. And there's not many people. Hold on a second. There's not many people that would allow their brains to be removed. You know, although in some cases, especially today, if you open up the head, you'll find that there's no brain to remove. But that's a different story. but the thing is that, I mean, people don't know this. I mean, the guy, you know, Trenbolone happens to be one of the most popular steroids. And, you know, these guys and these women or whatever, they're taking this stuff. And, you know, it's not going to happen right away. But if you use this for a couple of years, you could be setting yourself up for, you know, where you get like some boxers get after their career's over, where they get like a kind of dementia, you know, where it looks exactly like that. They could be screwing themselves up.
So it causes brain damage, Jerry?
It actually causes brain damage.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
As I told somebody, I did another podcast and I mentioned this and I said, you know, if I was competing and I took steroids, I said, there's one steroid I would never touch and it's Trenbolone. I would never touch. And I said that in that interview. And you know what somebody wrote in the comments, John and Phil? You know what they wrote?
No.
They wrote, this guy's full of shit. He said, I've used Trenbolone for 5 years and there's nothing wrong with my brain.
Right.
He spelled brain wrong.
Hey, Jerry, let me ask you this. What's Trenbolone called prior? Was there a name for that drug?
Well, Finagen and
Finagen. Okay.
Yeah.
I forget the other name, but it also had
it. I heard Finagen.
Yeah, Finagen. Yes. That was the veterinary form, and there was two other forms. It was actually released very briefly as a human drug, but I can't remember the exact trade name it had.
It,
you know?
It wasn't Parabolone, was it, Jerry?
Actually, I think it was.
Okay.
It was Parabolone. Okay. You're right.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's right. Parabolone it was. You're right.
Okay.
That was the trade name. You're right.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That's what it was. And, you know, this is recent stuff, guys. I mean, they didn't know this years ago about Trenbolone. And again, I'm not going to lie. Every study that has shown this has been animal studies, rats, various types of animals. Sure. You know, but the thing is, I mean, the structures that it affects in the rodent brains are the same that's found in human brains. So it's a very good chance. In fact, the neurologists that wrote these studies, at the end, they said, you know, we think this could also occur in human subjects. But obviously, it's unfortunately, you can't really test it because you'd have to open a person's head. Mm. Like even Alzheimer's, if somebody dies of Alzheimer's disease, the only way to really know is during an autopsy. There's no other way of knowing.
Yeah,
and that's the same with this. So, you know, it's causing a subtle brain damage that these guys don't know. So, you know, I mean.
Did you guys hear the commentary of the Arnold Classic when Arnold was joining the panel and he was doing the commentary?
I did. Yeah, I heard some of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Remind me, what did he say, John?
Well, he was talking about the classic physique, and he was kind of saying, you know, this is where the action is. That was the exact word. This is where the sport should go, is toward classic physique, because he liked the way the guys looked. And he also said straight out, he goes, let's be honest. He goes, these guys don't have to do as many drugs as the other guys do. Yeah. And he goes, bodybuilding's the only sport where we're having more deaths. And he talked about MMA, and he said, like, the MMA had, like, 2 deaths in the last 5 years. He goes, bodybuilders have had 20 deaths, or I don't know what his numbers were. But, you know, I was surprised that he was that open. And even Jake Wood, the guy who owns the Mr. Olympia, after one of those female competitors died this year, he said, we need some changes in the judging standard so they're not looking for such hardness, which is going to cause these competitors to use such diuretics.
Diuretics, yeah.
My question is he going to follow that through, or is that just talk? Is he going to actually change the judges?
Well, I don't know if they could really – the judges are going to not judge conditioning. I mean, it's like Pandora's box. It's like once we're used to a certain amount of conditioning, we're going to go backwards on it, you know?
That's the problem. It's easy to say, hard to do, you know?
Because
what are you going to do, award the a woman who enters, like, let's say, ripped and shredded or whatever – a woman who's smooth, you're going to give it the smooth woman over the rip. You know, it's not going to go well with the audience.
Yeah.
They don't give a crap about the health. They want to see what they consider the best person with.
Well, I remember when women's physique started, because I was doing some commentary for RX Muscle. And when women's physique started, we would be looking at these competitors and be like, oh, that girl's too hard. She's too vascular. They're going to mark her down for that. And they were actually doing that, you know. Yeah. So if you had, but now they don't do that anymore.
Right? No, it completely slipped back. And my question is, now you mentioned that how Arnold said about the classic physique, right?
Yeah.
Which makes sense. I agree. Because it harkens back to the way the physique's, you know, more symmetry, like what Phil looked like, you know, complete symmetry, head to toe body. But my question is, like, you know, there's always, again, this thing in the back of the mind of the competitors that they have to improve every year.
Yeah.
The classic, as you pointed out in a past podcast we did, John, when I mentioned this, you said to me, it probably won't be a big problem for the classic because it's a weight limit.
Yeah.
Right. These guys can't get too big, because if they get too big,
they're limited. Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're not going to, they're kicked out, or they can't compete. I don't know how it works, but
they can't compete. Yeah. They wouldn't be able.
Yeah. But my question is, you know, what are these guys like going to do to improve every year if they can't get bigger?
There's, you know what I mean? It affects the guys who are shorter more, because they're limited on weight. You know, if you're taller, if you're 6'2", the weight is higher, obviously, because you're taller.
Yeah, like the guy who just went, was it his third year or second year? Which is
third year, Chris Bumstead.
I mean, he's a taller guy, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the other guys, the other two guys he beat had as much quality muscle as him, but he gave the appearance of being bigger than him. I believe that played a large part and why he won, you know what I mean?
Well, Breon Ansley, who was the winner before Chris Bumstead, he's like my height. He's like 5'7", 5'8". So right. I think he's at the limit. So he actually looks great in the weeks before, but he's got to come down to make that weight.
That's
so
right.
It kind of flattens him out a little bit. So he's not really at his peak.
Yeah, but you see, a strange thing could happen there. In other words, they can't get too big, as you said. So they won't take, let's say, the program of a big Ramey or one of those.
Yeah.
Because that would knock him out of the competition. But what they can do is try and get harder and more ripped. You know, where, in other words, I look at a guy like Bumstead, and they say, well, he's bigger than, he has a bigger structure, he's taller than me. The only way I could beat this guy is to come in, like, just supernaturally shredded.
Right.
Where, you know, where I'm so cut that I'm almost painful to look at.
Yeah.
And have all the body parts, you know, in balance and symmetry. My question is, what are they going to do to get that look?
Yeah.
See? In other words, like, are they going to take, like, extra diuretics or maybe resort to something like DNP, which could kill you? You know what I mean? That'll kill you. That will kill you. That, to me, I always say that's the single most dangerous drug in bodybuilding, the second followed by diuretics, because both of them can kill you in a snap of a finger.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's an unanswered question. What are these guys going to do? Because, you know, there's a challenge for them every year in all of bodybuilding, female divisions, male, they have to show some improvement to win every year. And what are they going to resort to? That's my question.
So where do we go from here?
Yeah, where do you go from here? again, I hate to be redundant, but I don't have a good feeling about the future of especially the pro division, men and women. I mean, we're seeing little things going on here, people dying at a young age. And, you know, what's, I mean, this thing keeps up. What's going to happen? What are you going to get? Two people dying every month?
Yeah.
You know, what's the answer?
I know. What is the answer?
Again, I think the only answer is if the federations, whatever you want to call it, if they won't pay for the medical testing, then the bodybuilders will have to do it. You know, maybe get medical insurance. They got to monitor themselves, you know.
And what kind of tests should they do, Jerry?
They should get first of all, a complete blood panel, lipids, thyroid, liver panel is very important. And they should also, you know, maybe monitor certain tests that might show up, let's say, early cancers. You know, every so often get a colonoscopy. No, you don't do that all the time, maybe every 5 years or something like that. You know, that, you know, basically the things that could turn bad real fast. I think having regular blood tests, like I said, calcium scans of the coronary artery, that would be a big help.
Okay.
That could prevent a lot of heart attacks. So, you know, that stuff. I mean, again, it's, you know, I don't know how much of it will be covered by insurance, but, you know, this is the price they'll have to pay if they insist on staying on, as you said, larger doses year round.
Yeah.
They're going to have to monitor. They will get screwed up. I guarantee it. They will get screwed up. Now, on the other hand, the men and women who get off the drugs like we did in the old days, not me, I mean, the guys in the old days, they don't have to worry about that crap, because the only problem they have is if they stay on the steroids high dose year after year, they're going to cause those structural changes to the heart
that
when they get older will set them up for things like congestive heart failure. But even there's a bright side. If they eat good, don't get obese, don't get high blood pressure, continue to exercise, they can prevent, even with the structural changes, they can prevent stuff like congestive heart failure from happening. But they have the keys in their own hands.
I wonder if a guy came along who was a top title winner, somebody with influence like a Chris Bumstead. I mean, that guy's got more followers. I was interviewing him at the Olympia on this thing called Meet the Olympians on Thursday night. He had literally all these kids standing there watching him. He had all these fans, like everywhere. He had a booth, and his line went through the whole expo. I mean, this guy is the most popular guy. If someone like him would go out and say, hey, I don't use the drugs all year. I only use them, you know, a few months before the contest, you know. If someone with influence like that, maybe that could influence other people coming up.
I think that would be a definite help.
Yeah.
You know, a popular guy like him, you know, because like you said, a lot of younger guys look up to him, you know.
Yeah.
They like his physique. I mean, I remember after he won last year, you guys probably saw these photos. There was photos of him posing with Big Ramey.
Yeah, I remember that.
I say they were in shorts, I remember, right?
Yeah.
And if you read the comments underneath, most of the comments said, Bumstead looks like the real Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
Most of the people preferred Bumstead's physique to Big Ramey, right?
Yeah.
So the guy is very popular. And as crazy as it sounds, I know this sounds nuts, but even if Big Ramey himself, who's, you know, no, I mean, you don't have to figure whether he's on drugs or not, but even if he made a statement like if he, for example, parroted Rich Piana and said, look, it's no secret that the guys in the elite division of the pros use steroids. But if you're not going to compete, don't try and do what I do and the other guys do. You're only going to hurt yourself, and you're going to harm yourself and possibly die. Don't do it. That, I think, would help. You know, it's like Yul Brynner. You remember the actor Yul Brynner?
Yeah.
He was a heavy smoker for years. And when he got lung cancer, he was dying. You know? So what he did is he contacted I can't remember, some health organization. And he volunteered. He wanted to make a commercial warning other people not to smoke.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? So he might have had a whole tracheotomy or something.
Oh, did he really? Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he says, I smoked for years. He says, I admit it. He says, now I'm paying the price. He says, I am dying. Don't do what I did. Don't smoke. That was a simple message. you know. Well, you know,
when I saw the pictures of Bumstead and Ramey next to each other, people were saying, well, Bumstead should do the open, but he's going to have to gain like 20 or 30 more pounds. And I'm like, right. Why? Why can't he just go in looking like he does now?
Right.
I saw that too.
Because back in the day, Frank Zane was winning, and he wasn't gaining all the size to get to beat these guys. He was going at his best.
But you know what the funny thing is? Think about it for a second, guys. Let's say Chris Bumstead took that advice, and he said, you know what? Let's say all this adulation got to his head, and he said to himself, he said, I think I could beat these guys in the pro. I think I'm going to go for the Open Olympia.
Yeah.
And he started to use the emulate their drug programs.
Well, there you go.
You know what?
Yeah.
He would look like shit.
Yeah.
You know what? Because in your mind, picture his physique right now. He doesn't have that heavy a bone structure.
Right.
So see that, you know, for a big man, Phil, you see how small his waist looks?
Yeah.
Frank Zane had that too. They get that small waist and narrow hips because they have a relatively small bone structure. Height.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean? That means he can't hold a lot more muscle.
No, it ruins his lines. Yeah.
Exactly. There you go. If he tries to build too much muscle, this is what Frank experienced. He told me himself.
Yeah.
Years ago, I think we talked about this, John. He decided that, you know, he was competing at 180 or something like that.
185,
you know? And he became a pro, and his first impulse was, I'm going to put on some weight because I got to compete against guys like Arnold. I got to get bigger. I remember him telling me, he says, you know, I went to 205. That's it, 205. He's only 5'9". He went to 205. He says, but I had a revelation. He says, I was in my car waiting at a red light, and I realized that my stomach hung over. The fat hung over the steering wheel. He says, I immediately went back on the diet. He says, and I never entertained any thoughts of trying to get big. I decided to go in the opposite direction.
Right.
It is ripped and fine-tuned as possible. And of course, the rest is history. He won the Olympia 3 times. But right. Chris Bumstead just doesn't have the structure.
Doesn't have the structure, Jerry. You know? Right.
I mean, Big Ramey has a structure like a freaking elephant. I mean, he could put on a lot of – well, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, 600 pounds, Ronnie Coleman, a gigantic structure, you know? But I mean, this man does not have this. I have nothing but respect for Bumps. I'm not trying to put him down, but I think he doesn't strike me as a stupid guy. And I think he knows in his head
that's why he's going to stay in that division.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
I mean, he will probably do what Lee Haney and Phil Heath, he'll probably just compete, win it, you know. I don't know how many times, who knows, 7, 8, 9 times, whatever he wants. Then he'll retire. By that time, he'll be such a legend that, you know, he can do whatever he wants. He can, you know, he already has a supplement company, which shocked me. I was watching a video of him where he made these videos of him preparing for the Olympia. And I'm watching it, and he says, now I'm going to make a protein drink. And I'm looking, I'm saying, what the hell does it say on the can? Bummed, what's it say?
C-bum.
What's it, what?
C-bum.
C-bum, yeah.
C-bum.
And then he adds the C-bum protein powder, and he adds two other supplements also say C-bum.
Right.
I slap my head in the head, son of a bitch, I'm watching an infomercial.
Of course.
But you know what the funny thing is? He never mentioned it. He never said, well, these are my personals. All he did is make sure he showed the labor.
Right.
Very subtle. Very subtle. So, you know, he could do something like that. I mean, I think that's what the guy's probably going to do.
He'll make millions, no doubt.
Yeah, he'll just continue to compete, you know, and year after year. And the thing is that I don't know whether the other guys can get good enough because he is a little taller than like the guy you mentioned, you know, who has that guy has one of the best. Phil, he has a back like you, that guy. What's his name again, John?
Leon Ansley.
Yeah, he has a tremendous beautiful back, definition everywhere.
Yeah.
I personally think he's better.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Right.
Yeah.
But you said the height does make a difference.
Height, yeah.
And that's what tipped it over to Bumstead.
When I looked at the contest, I said to myself, the only reason why Bumstead won, and again, not trying to put down Chris Bumstead, was his height. Because Breon looked to me actually a more complete physique.
More complete.
But he was shorter.
Yeah.
So they gave it to the taller man, who gives the impression it's like an illusion.
It is an illusion.
He's not that much bigger than the other guys. If you really look close, if you see his arm, he's not that much bigger. But because of the height, when he stands next to him, he looks bigger. It's an illusion. Yeah. The judges judged him on that, and he won.
Well, they always say a good big man will always be the big, good, short arm.
Sure. Yeah. Everything being equal, it'll go to the taller guy.
Yeah.
They were. But I also believe, and I agree with Arnold about this, and I don't know if you guys agree with this, I think that the Classic will come to the point where it is the most popular bodybuilding event. It will eventually greatly supersede Mr. Olympia itself. Mr. Olympia will become like a niche freak thing. Whereas the guys, they'll be forced to pay these guys more money because these guys are going to get like Bumstead and Breon. They're going to get more and more popular because you know why? People can relate more to them.
Yeah. You can sell them to a mainstream audience.
Exactly. John, when you saw those guys lining up to see Bumstead, it's because these guys are looking at him and saying,
He's got a great
physique, and you know what? You know, I want to look like that, and I think I can.
Yeah. That's what we had when we were younger, too, right?
Exactly.
We were.
Yeah, right. But when you look at Brig Ramey, who's going to go up and say, he doesn't have a great physique, but who's going to go up and say, I can look like
even an idiot? 304 pounds.
How many people can walk around with 304 pounds in that?
Right.
It's like a freak of nature, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's like having six fingers on one. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Right.
So this stuff, I predict that the classic. Now, what about men's physique with the board shorts? I don't think it's going to get as popular.
For
the
simple,
we've talked about this, and Phil, I've talked about, we've laughed about this, but call me old school, call me cantankerous, but I just can't. And all due respect, those guys look great. I mean, their upper bodies. They're very defined.
They look great, yeah.
Some of them have fantastic – I mean, better than I ever looked, I admit it. But I just can't handle the board shorts.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, the largest muscles in the body are the thighs.
And the hardest training body part.
Yeah.
Exactly, right. And to cover them up in a competition, for what reason? In other words, what are you trying to say? What's the message? You're trying to say, here, we're having these guys go on stage. They're wearing these, surfer shorts, whatever. These guys were actually just passing by, and we told them to come up on stage and talk. I'm trying to make it look like anybody can do it. So they're trying to key into the fact that.
Well, I think that's kind of what the original concept was, but they got so big now. They're just they're like bodybuilders with board shorts.
See, that's where they made their mistake. In other words, they figured if these guys, come up in board shorts, people relate to them because they're not that big. Again, there's a limitation on the sides also.
Yeah.
But they have the great abs. And your people see the board. Hey, they're not even wearing posing shorts. We could do that.
I think it was the same thing with that division when it started.
Yeah.
The guys who were too muscular were marked down.
That's exactly right. But as you point out, the nature of bodybuilding.
Right.
Can't escape it, Bill. You know this. We've all trained,
Right.
You want to always get bigger. You always want to get better.
Yeah.
You don't want to stay the same. You got to show improvement.
Well, there'll be no end to this.
Nope. And again, I hope I'm wrong, but I just don't have a good feeling, man. I mean, I don't have a, I mean, you know, Sean, I mean, I got to tell you, I was shocked when I saw it. When Phil, you're the one who told me.
Yeah.
I mean, I wake up and there's a message from Phil Williams. Sean wrote in his diary. I said, what? I actually said it out loud. And my dog looked at me. What's going on? He said, no. I was shocked at Sean Roth because I had no idea. I mean, 40s. I knew he wasn't that old.
That's relatively young.
Well, that's why I mentioned those other Mr. Olympia winners who passed away at the beginning.
Such
a shock.
What I'd like to see. And again, this is out of some sort of weirdness, but I'd like to see if they do autopsies on George Peterson and Sean Roden.
Yeah.
This way we can know. It would be very helpful to know.
It would be for that reason,
what killed. I mean, they did autopsies on Rich Piana What's his name again?
Dallas, maybe.
Dallas, yeah. And I actually wrote an article in my Applied Metabolisms. I wrote an article basically discussing the autopsies, going into details of you know, how the findings might have played a role in their death. And I think it's important to know what these guys died very young. And, you know, it's important to know what exactly killed them.
Yeah.
You know? What if it turned out, for example, what if it turned out, and again, I'm not saying this, what if it turns out that either Sean or George took a dangerous drug? Let's say, what if it turns out that, again, I'm not saying this happened, but what if, let's say, somebody, Sean decided to take a bunch of cocaine and it caused a heart attack? Well, that has nothing to do with bodybuilding at all.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it's not going to remove the tragedy of his death, but it also removes the stigma that's going right now, where I'm sure a couple of jack-offs are going to go. I'm sure they're already doing it. Well, Sean Roddenberry, he was a heavy steroid user, and the steroids killed him. You know, this thing, they're talking out of their ass.
Right.
You're not going to know anything until an autopsy is done, you know? Yeah. And a toxicology test, you know, where they find anything. Like Mike Mentzer. I remember his autopsy results. Somebody sent it to me. The man had 12 different drugs in his blood.
Wow.
Three antidepressants, a muscle relaxant. He had a whole bunch of drugs, 12 different drugs in his bloodstream.
That's what contributed to the heart attack.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
So, you know, what can I say?
All right, guys. Well, thank you for joining me for another podcast. This was kind of a sobering podcast, but I think it needed to be discussed. And I did want to mention or give some tribute to Sean Roden, because he was a Mr. Olympia winner. And such a tragedy that he died at such a young age. So thanks for giving me all your insight, Jerry and Phil.
Hey, guys.
Yeah, I just want to add that, you know, I happen to have, like I said, I knew Sean Roden, not a close friend like Phil is, you know, but I knew him. And I just want to say that for people who didn't meet him, or the guy was a really nice guy. Mm-hmm. He was very humble. He wasn't a bragger. He was a down-to-earth nice guy who was nice to everyone. I just want to let people know that. And from what I understand, George Peterson was too, although I never met him, but I understand. Yeah. So it's just a very sad situation. Very sad.
Yeah. You know? All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me again. Again, Jerry, your Applied Metabolics newsletter is on appliedmetabolics.com.
Appliedmetabolics.com. Yeah. And like I say, I got a lot of interesting thing. I'm still working on this thing about steroids in the brain, but I've learned a lot just from doing the research. It's really shocking, some of the effects. I mean, I don't think anyone reading this, a hardcore steroid user, is going to suddenly stop using it, but
it's information, though. Good information.
Exactly. But it'll make them, let's say, stop and think for a minute about what's up the line for them if they continue to do it. Let's put it out, you know.
Yeah. Very good.
So that's at appliedmetabolics.com, and I want to thank you and, thank you, Phil, also for joining us.
Yeah.
And we will look forward to having you guys on the show again soon one day.
Hey, Jerry, I'll give you a call at the end of the week, buddy.
Sounds good, Phil. Okay, good.
John, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Okay, guys. Thanks for joining me again on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We'll talk to you soon.
And keep up that good work, John, man. I love your videos. You know, you're keeping the history of, like I said to you every time, I'll say it again, you are keeping the history of bodybuilding alive by direct, not this secondary crap where these guys make videos where they pull shit off the internet and rip it. You're doing face to face with the people themselves, and you're keeping it alive. And I'm glad you're doing it. You're a definite asset to the sport. Seriously.
Thank you,
John. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. All take care.
Okay, guys.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks again to my guest, Jerry Branum. And Phil Williams, I always love when these guys join us on the show. They're always interesting, and they are welcome back anytime, and hopefully we can have them back again soon. I want to thank our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And thanks also to the loyal Patreon donors who donate money to the show every month. We could not do the show without you guys, so thank you very much for contributing to the show. If anyone out there wants to help contribute to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, you can just go to our website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com,
And in the upper right-hand corner, you see the link for Patreon. All right. And like I said, if you guys want to email me about this week's show, just do that at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. So to celebrate Lou Ferrigno's recent 70th birthday on November 9th last week, I'm going to read this article from the April 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine. Mike Mentzer was on the cover of this magazine with his girlfriend, Kathy Gelfo. But coincidentally, Lou was on the cover of the March issue of Muscle and Fitness, which was the month before. But they've got this article in here called The Two Faces of Lou Ferrigno, written by Bill Reynolds, who was editor-in-chief of Muscle and Fitness at the time. It says, fantasy spills into reality sometimes so that people think Lou Ferrigno really is the Hulk. But Lou is careful to keep the two personalities separate and to retain his own identity. There's a little bit of the Hulk in everyone, Lou Ferrigno said with a half smile. The way I play the character, he's a hero who doesn't bother keeping his emotions bottled up inside himself. Everybody feels the urge to Hulk out occasionally, but he actually does it. It's an eerie feeling to see the Incredible Hulk smile, and it's difficult at times to remember that it's really Lou Ferrigno under all that paint and putty. But it was Lou, his girlfriend Carla, and myself sitting in his trailer on location near Los Angeles. Over half a billion people worldwide have seen the Incredible Hulk television show, and fantasy spills into reality sufficiently so that at times people think Lou Ferrigno really is the Hulk. There is, well, a little bit of green rage inside Louie, but it's more gentle giant than his friends see on the day-to-day basis. As a skinny, partially deaf, and introverted teenager, Ferrigno often retreated into a fantasy world populated by Marvel Comics superheroes. I avidly read all the comics and had a huge collection of them, Louie remembers. Superman, Batman, Captain America, The Incredible Hulk. I love reading about these superheroes, figures, who were all built like Mr. Universe. I used to have all these fantasies like growing up to be a giant of a man, fighting off all sorts of scurvy characters and winning the heart of every pretty young lady for miles around. But in reality, I was skinny, too shy to even talk to girls, and pathetically weak. My fantasies allowed me to escape from all this. In a few minutes, I could be the combination of Superman and Captain America. But I can never in my wildest dreams imagine myself as the Incredible Hulk. Being all green and weighing 1,000 pounds took him totally out of the realm of reality. But ironically, Louie grew up to be the Hulk, not Superman. And he's had as big an effect on the comic character as the Hulk has had on him. The two have literally changed each other, and for the better. The Hulk originally was very blocky looking, big knees, huge feet, ape-like muscles, Lou explained, standing up briefly to turn on the trailer's air conditioning unit. In full makeup, Louie can't sweat. The paint closes his pores, so the trailer has to be kept cool. Since the show has been on, the character in the comics has turned into a bodybuilder. He acquired size, small joints, cuts, and veins. In other words, the comic book version of the Incredible Hulk has gone from fire hydrant to Mr. Universe. Indeed, the character is now almost an exact replica of Lou Ferrigno in top shape. But despite Louie's close connection with the character and his positive effect on it, Marvel Comics owns the Hulk, and it controls its copyright with an iron fist. It should be obvious that 50 million American kids watching Lou Hulk out every week translates into a lot of comic book sales. Ferrigno makes a lot of money from his acting, personal appearances, and mail order business, but the royalties Marvel passes on to him wouldn't cover the average TV football fan's monthly beer bill. It's crazy, Lou says. As much as I do for the character, I can't even advertise myself as the Hulk. That would be stepping into Marvel's domain, and they're not about to stand for that. I don't need their money, but I would like to say that I'm the Hulk. It's only fair. In 1973, a 21-year-old Lou Ferrigno weighed 250 pounds and was ripped to shreds. He swept inexorably to the Mr. Eastern America, Mr. America, and Mr. Universe in his first year of IFBB competition, beating the likes of Ken Waller, Mike Katz, and Albert Beckles in the process. The next year, he again won Mr. Universe, but he was too lean-looking to take an older and infinitely more experienced Arnold Schwarzenegger in the Olympia. For the 1975 Olympia, Ferrigno resolved to match Arnold's superhuman mass. Unfortunately, the pendulum swung too far for Louie, and he was overbulked. As anyone who has seen the film Pumping Iron will recall, the Austrian oak brushed Louis aside with majestic poise and disdain. Despite my success as an actor, Lou asserts, I'm still a 100% bodybuilder. and any bodybuilder worth his salt aspires to be the greatest of all time. The only way for me to prove that I am the greatest would be to defeat Arnold someday. And I'm confident that my body's matured enough so now that I can. I could win the Olympia and beat Zane and Franco, but people would never accept me as number one if Arnold wasn't there. I could weigh 300 pounds and be ripped to the bone, but I'd still be number two. The only way to establish myself as numero uno would be to challenge all the greats of the past, Arnold, Sergio, Scott, and all the present champions at least a year before a major contest. Then if I beat everyone at that show, I would be where I want to be. Arnold would have had his shot at me, and so will all the rest. If they don't take it, that's their problem. The Incredible Hulk breaks into a grin again at the prospect, and I wonder if he'll be at this year's Olympia in Sydney, Australia. Frankly, I doubt it, Bill, he answers, but you never can tell. I'd need 4 to 6 months of uninterrupted training for that, and the series just doesn't give me the time. Following his South African debacle, Louis was invited to compete in ABC's Superstars television show, in which champion athletes are matched in a decathlon-like polyglot of athletic events. He startled the sporting world by winning his preliminary section and placing very respectably in the final. Lou has said, I simply had to show people that bodybuilders are athletes, and I feel that I did just that. Some woman in the audience was quite vocal about how muscle-bound I'd be and how poorly I'd do in the competition. By the end of the preliminary round, however, I'd gained the respect of every athlete against whom I competed. They certainly didn't think I was some muscle-bound oaf because I'd beaten them all in their own games. Lou eventually parlayed his athletic ability into a pro football contract in Canada, despite the fact that he never played a down of even high school football. During training camp, however, he tore an Achilles tendon, thus ended a promising career in pro sports. Ultimately, Lou's thoughts returned to bodybuilding, his first and greatest love. The Mr. Olympia contest, bodybuilding's holy grail, beckoned to him. And in late 1976, he began to train seriously for a comeback. But Lou Ferrigno's plans to annex the 1977 Mr. Olympia came to an unexpected end late that summer. He moved to California from Brooklyn to train for the Olympia under Joe Weider's direction. And by August, he was in absolutely phenomenal shape. If I'd been to that Olympia, there's no way Zane would have beaten me, Louis says emphatically. But Universal Studios contacted me. I took a screen test and I was hired on the spot to in the pilot film for the Incredible Hulk television series. It was the hardest decision I've ever made because I was letting Joe Weider and all my fans down, but I was convinced I could do more for bodybuilding as the Hulk than as Mr. Olympia. And besides, I was still young and I could go back to competitive bodybuilding at any time. Lou actually got his part as the Incredible Hulk in a somewhat roundabout fashion. Richard Kiel, James Bond's friend Jaws, was the original nominee. In fact, Kiel apparently played the Hulk for a week or two. One day, the producer's son was on the set to see his comic book hero come to life. He was shocked at Kiel's appearance, and he blurted out to his father, "That's not the Hulk. He doesn't have enough muscles." After a few hours of high-level reevaluation, the producer decided to find a very large bodybuilder for the part. Of course, at 6'5", 275 pounds, Louis was the largest, and he was invited for a screen test. The very day he was on the set filming for real, and within a few months, he was a national hero. The Incredible Hulk has made Lou Ferrigno a very affluent and universally loved man, but at times it hasn't been easy. My whole mind and body occasionally rebels at putting on the makeup, Lou shivers. At 5 a.m. on a cold morning, it is actually physically painful to slap on all that crap. The nose and the forehead pieces don't weigh much, but after 12 to 14 hours in them, it feels like they're a ton of lead. Once I'm painted, my existence is extremely limited. I can't lie down, I can't work out, and I can't go outside the trailer unless I'm filming because I have to keep my body cool and the paint all in order. My working days are spent reading, taking care of correspondence, and watching television between widely spaced takes. I'd swear that if it wasn't for reading Muscle Builder magazine, I'd go a little stir crazy at times. 3 years on the series have not gone without incident. Filming in the desert last year, Lou suffered severe heat exhaustion. This year, a tumble from a studio airplane mock-up cracked his wrist. Even more frightening, one of his massive contact lenses, which can only be tolerated for a half hour at a time when he is hulked out, slipped up into the top of his eye, where it lodged for a painful and terrifying 45 minutes before it could be removed. Manuel Perry doubles for Lou on the most hazardous stunts, such as jumps from cliffs and high-rise buildings. Unfortunately, Perry doesn't look enough like Louis to be able to double for him in the stunts involving close-up shots. I'm afraid of heights because of my ear problem has affected my balance, says Lou. But I've jumped off a ledge into an airbag while carrying a girl in my arms. I just closed my eyes and jumped. My heart didn't slow down for a week after that one. Some innocuous-looking stunts are the most dangerous. Smashing through a window or a wall is ordinarily a very safe stunt for the average stuntman. The window is made of spun sugar, the wall of balsa wood, and the stuntman is fully dressed. But Louis has to do the stunt with his upper body exposed, and at times hundreds of tiny particles must be removed from his skin with tweezers after he's through. It's no picnic being the Hulk. Everyone loves the Hulk, Lou laughs. You'd be amazed at the mail I get. It comes from 8-year-old kids, from 80-year-old great-grandmothers, and from everyone in between. It seems like I've given a lot of very big people, like basketball and football players, a greater degree of normalcy. Compared to the Hulk, they're pretty normal-looking, and I get a lot of letters from them. A box addressed to Louis recently arrived at Weider headquarters, and when Joe Weider passed it on, Lou found a handmade spoon rack from a deaf and mentally retarded boy in Canada. Lou's eyes glistened for a moment, and he vowed to send the young man an autographed photo and personal thank you note. I get so many letters that the studio handles the mail, says Lou. I simply can't answer them because of the volume of letters. But that kid's gift really touched me. Can you imagine how difficult it must have been for him to overcome his handicap and make this gift for me? It's just incredible. Lou Ferrigno is justifiably proud of the inspiration he seems to provide to handicapped youngsters. His own hearing was badly damaged by an ear infection when he was 3, and only dogged persistence allowed him to overcome the speech and hearing problems that resulted. Lou knows the meaning of struggle, admires those who strive for a normal existence, and gladly donates his time to fundraising telethons for handicapped children. Lou is modest about having become a sex symbol. Originally, a few women wanted to shyly touch his arm. Then it went further. Soon they wanted a peck on the cheek, then a hug and a kiss. I finally had to put an end to it, claims Lou, glancing shyly at Carla, who was starting to get a little out of control. Most of Lou's fans want to know what he's really like behind the makeup. I'm still the same Lou Ferrigno as I was when I started to work on the series, but it would have been easy to be affected by the whole thing, says Lou. The movie industry is full of stories of people who have been chewed up by the system and spit out. I'm determined to retain my sanity, to remain a down-to-earth, honest, and life-loving individual. You can ask any of the guys at the World's Gym, and they all say that I'm the same guy I was 2 or 3 years ago. I still train hard, and I still enjoy being with my friends. It's just that half of me now is up on the television screen every Friday. Nobody would blame me if I got a little schizoid at times. Occasionally, I feel like David Banner, because half of me is the Incredible Hulk, and half is Lou Ferrigno. Still, I'm determined to keep the two separate, to retain my own identity. And Lou Ferrigno has succeeded quite well in keeping himself intact in such a fragmenting business. He hasn't hulked out in real life for years, and he seems even more stable than the first time I met him in Gold's Gym in the late 1976. He's still Lou Ferrigno, bodybuilder, and one day he will no doubt return to competition. And green or flesh-toned, he'll undoubtedly be out to prove that he's the greatest bodybuilder of all time. And don't bet that he won't succeed. All right. Good article on Lou Ferrigno. From 1980. And of course, Lou did go on to compete again, but it wasn't until 1992, the first year that Dorian Yates won. So it was another 12 years after this article was written. The series of The Incredible Hulk lasted for 5 years. And then after that, Lou got into doing a few movies. He played Hercules in a few movies, and he also played Sinbad. And I think he got involved in some television shows as well. So Lou was very busy as an actor. He tried to make the most of his Hollywood career. And then, like I said, he did return to competition in 1992 and 1993 at the Olympia. And then he did the very first Masters Mr. Olympia in 1994, where he thought for sure he was going to win, but he took second to Robbie Robinson. And I think he was very disappointed in that. And then after that, Lou decided to no longer compete. I believe he was married to Carla at the time, and I think they even had kids. Yeah, at the time they had a couple kids. So it was, I guess, Lou and Carla decided it was just ridiculous to keep competing, and he got the competition bug out of his system. Unfortunately, it's a shame that Lou never did compete in that 1977 Mr. Olympia against Frank Zane and Robbie and Boyer Coe and all the others. I think I mentioned on this podcast many times the story of meeting Lou Ferrigno back in 1977. And that was around, I believe, July or August, when they were filming The World's Strongest Man. And I got to see Lou in person, and he was humongous. So it really would have been interesting to see how he would have looked at that 1977 Mr. Olympia. There's no doubt he would have been in the best shape of his life. And if he would have peaked, he probably would have won the Mr. Olympia, because he definitely would have looked better than 74 or 75. And the pictures he had in Muscle Builder leading up to that contest at the time, Lou was looked really, really big and full and really cut, and he really brought up his weak points. So it would have been interesting to see him against a top Frank Zane. And, of course, Robbie kind of missed his peak that year. Everybody thought Robbie was going to win, but Robbie was holding some water, and he was not at his best. So I think Lou probably would have beat Robbie. So, man, that would have been an interesting contest. But it wasn't meant to be, and Frank Zane was a three-time Mr. Olympia. All right, that's it for the show this week, guys. Hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Stay safe out there. Keep training hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.